I press down and blow, producing a high, smooth note, E flat. It's the right one. After that, it all comes back to me. The notes, the tempo, the melody. My fingers dance over the keys. Handel's Flute Sonata in E minor. It starts out slow and steady. Adagio. Notes marching in an orderly line, smooth as glass. I take my time, settling into a series of rolling measures, my upper half swaying as I lean into the music and feel each note. As the third rule of music craft states, with all your soul do play your part, for magic rises from the heart. That's why recorded spells don't work. They might sound nice, but magic comes from the musician, not the music. The notes and instruments are just how you control it. And that means you have to stay focused and keep your attention on the spell, or you won't produce so much as a curl of magic. It takes your whole heart and soul to pull off a proper spell. And a good musician knows controlling your thoughts is just as important as controlling your breath and fingers. Sweet tones turn into curls of green light and swirl through the air. Most of them, directed by my focus on the acorn, drift to the pot and sink into the soil. The magic smells like water on leaves, a rainy day in spring. The first movement goes perfectly. I transition into the second, picking up the tempo, allegro. Now my fingers begin to race, notes trilling and fluttering. And the magic changes accordingly, the green curls of light shortening into brief bursts, drifting like dandelion fluff through the air and hovering around the acorn. The longer I play, the more lights come to life, until my skin and the table and the flute are illuminated with dancing green sparks. The chandeliers overhead reflect the lights until the whole room glitters, the mirrored walls reflecting endless Amelias. Finally, the acorn begins to jiggle, then splits into two pale halves as a tender white shoot pries its way free. Growth spells are one of my favorites. They're so full of hope and happiness. Seeing the little plant burst into life, straining to reach for the sun, makes my soul expand. I risk a quick glance up, just as the sprout begins to unfurl its first leaves, and I see the maestros watching just as grimly as before. They don't look too impressed. Mustache even looks a little bored. My heart squeezes. What if I'm doing something wrong? What if I misunderstood the instructions or picked the wrong spell? What if they don't like my technique? Or what if they decided the moment they saw my muddy shoes and my chicken poop jeans that I'm not Mistwick material? Squeet! The jarring note splits the air like a scream, and my whole body contracts, my fingers momentarily freezing on the keys. The fragile shoot shivers in its pot. No, 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 no! Desperately, I keep playing as if the bad note never happened. I don't dare look at the maestros. But then I hit a wrong note, and another squeaky A, and sweat runs down my face and my neck and slimes my palms. I keep picturing their stony expressions, especially Mustache Man, frowning at me and thinking, "Who is this weirdo? She doesn't belong here. Send in the real musicians." Suddenly, I hear a shout from the maestros, and I look up. And I'm so startled by what I see that I stop playing altogether. The green motes of light all die, as suddenly as they appeared, like startled fireflies. I stand frozen in horror in the following silence, gaping at Mustache Man. Or rather, at the mustache. It has sprouted so much hair that it now hangs to his belly. He could braid it and toss it over his shoulder if he wanted. He could string it between two trees and use it for a hammock. By letting my mind get distracted, I lost control of the magic, and it fixed on the maestro instead of the acorn. The growth spell worked, at least, just not on the right thing. The other three maestros gape at the man, who is slowly lifting his ridiculously long mustache with both hands. Then his eyes rise to me, shiny with rage. "Young lady," says the maestro in the dress, "finish your spell, please." She shaking. I raise my flute and play the last few measures, but it's too late to undo the damage. The sprout had put out 3 leaves, but that last awful note had not only broken the spell, it had twisted it completely. In response, the shoot bent sideways at a 90-degree angle, so the whole thing is now shaped like an upside-down L. The leaves droop sadly, as if heartbroken. Kind of like how my heart is breaking. I lower my flute and stare numbly.
"Somebody bring me a pair of scissors,"
bellows Mustache Man.
"And you,"
he points at me.
"Get out of here."
I'm sorry, I say. "I can start over, or I can play a trimming spell and fix it. Please, you'll see."
"We've seen plenty,"
he growls, pulling more and more of his mustache up and onto the table. It coils there like a pile of brown yarn.
"Where are those scissors?"
I'm still blinking at them, please gathering in my throat, as I hear the doors behind me open and the woman outside runs in and slams a pair of scissors onto the table. Then she pulls me away by my elbow. I don't even have time to put away my instrument. I can only bundle my flute under one arm, grab my case in the other, and shuffle quickly after her.
"Wait, please," I shout. "I can do better, I promise."
I'm pushed through the doors to find myself staring at the other kids, who watch with wide eyes. Tears run down my cheeks, and a pressure builds inside my chest. I can't breathe.
2, 4, 3,
the woman yells. I run through the ballroom and into the lobby, out the front doors, bursting into the sunny parking lot. Gran shouts my name, but I don't stop. I just want to get as far away from here as possible, back to the train station, back home. "I'm sorry, Mom," I whisper, doubling over as a sob rises in my lungs. "I tried, but I..." The words stick in my throat. "I guess I'm nothing like you after all." Chapter 4. The Treehouse Blues. My treehouse is hidden deep in the forest, out of sight of any other houses. I climb up and sit on the edge of the floor, legs dangling. After 2 weeks of shutting myself up in my room and crying into my pillow, I was finally pushed, literally, out the front door by Gran, who told me my sulkathon had gone on long enough and some sunshine would do me good. So I slunk off, taking my flute with me. The world didn't end because I screwed up one audition. It only feels that way. The woods here seem silent at first, but if you know how to listen, you can hear a whole symphony, magic of an entirely different sort. Wind shivering through the needles, pines creaking as they lean, squirrels chirping and birds trilling. Little white mushrooms stubble a fallen log below, beneath the long, glossy ferns that are starting to turn brown at the tips of their leaves. Looking at all the growing things around me, I'm reminded of my audition tree. So young and fragile and hopeful, only to end up mangled and broken. My flute case is beside me. I snap it open and take out my instrument, sliding the pieces together without even having to look. Then, lying on my back, I stare up at the roof of my treehouse and try to think about what Mom would do. "I wish I could talk to you," I think. Putting my flute to my chin, I begin to play. Instead of choosing a spell, I just let the notes flow from my fingers. I close my eyes and stop thinking and just feel the melody. Usually I know what notes are coming because I've studied the spell and practiced it 100 times. But this time, each note is a surprise. The melody begins slow, then races faster and faster, falling like rain and then skittering upward. Where the music comes from, I don't know. I've never tried anything like this before. Always, I've had my sheet music or memorized the spell, striving to hit each note perfectly. But this time, it's like someone else is playing through me. It's like I'm crossing a foggy river, jumping from one stone before I can even see the next, landing each time with a flutter of surprise and relief.
The notes rise up from the bottom of my soul and carry me along, pulling me deeper into a strange melody, asking me to follow. I let them guide me, trusting them. And as I do, I think about my mom, laughing in her graduation gown, confident, happy, beautiful, her new golden maestro pin gleaming on her collar. Whatever happened to that pin, I wonder? It wasn't with the flute, and Gran has never mentioned having it. I wish you could tell me what to do. I wish you were here. I shut my eyes and let the music take over, until I forget how long I'm lying there on the hard floorboards, the cool wind rolling over me, and the trees sighing all around. The music is instinct. It's my heartbeat spun into sound. It's a spell entirely my own. My fingers seem to play with a mind of their own, like I couldn't stop even if I wanted to. The wind sweeps across the forest, getting stronger, rattling and rustling the trees around me, stirring my hair and leaving a trail of goosebumps up my arms. For a brief moment, my whole body feels cold. I hear a rustle nearby, and when I open my eyes, I see rainbow tendrils of magic swirling from my flute and coiling upward. All around my treehouse is a spiraling column of pine needles and twigs and leaves caught up in the spell, a slow and gentle tornado of woodsy debris borne on the current of my music. The funnel rises to the treetops, glittering and twisting. The air smells of burned matches. I've never seen magic like this before, made of every color, instead of the usual yellow or green or white spell. For a moment, I'm awestruck, caught up in the strange beauty of it. Then, panicking, I break off the spell, and the bits of leaves and sticks all rain down on me. I sit up and wipe them from my face and clothes, heart pounding. Fooling around with music is a dangerous thing. What if I'd started a wildfire? They should add a new rule of music craft. Mess around, you burn stuff down. A shadow crosses my face. Shielding the sun, I look up and see a butterfly drifting through the trees. It circles, then swoops toward me, wings lazily flapping. Startled, I jump to my feet. It's like no butterfly I've ever seen before. It's white, almost as if the butterfly is completely made of paper, like an origami bird. I stare in shock as it lands on my outstretched palm, wings falling still. Then, before my eyes, it unfolds itself into an envelope, sealed with a gold foil sticker shaped like a treble clef. Written in elegant letters of gold ink is my name, Amelia Jones. And below that is the crest of the Mistwick School of Music Craft, a harp wreathed in ivy, below a banner stamped with Audientibus Musica Audest, the school motto. Music is there for those who listen. My heart sinks. I knew I'd get the rejection letter. I just didn't expect it would come flying like a butterfly. But still, maybe it's better this way. I can get it over with. I can put Mistwick and that awful audition behind me forever. Might as well rip off the Band-Aid, right? But as I slide my thumb between the two halves of the paper, my heart does a flip. For a moment, I imagine a different future, in which the words inside bring a smile to my face, in which I run into the house shouting for Gran, opening my suitcase, packing my clothes and my flute, leaving for the big wide world and my future as a maestro, finally following my mom's footsteps. But as soon as I open the paper and see the actual words inside, it will all be over. No more daydreams. So I put it in the pocket of my skirt, still folded, and head home, my flute case swinging at my side. It's getting dark anyway, and maybe it'll be easier if I wait and open the letter in the morning. All I want to do is go to bed and sleep, but Gran catches me and forces me into the kitchen.
"We need to talk," she says.
"Can we do it tomorrow?" But she pulls out a chair from the kitchen table and points at it, relentless. With a sigh, I sit and plop my case on the floor. Gran stands across from me, her arms crossed.
"I won't have you moping around this house for days on end, young lady. We need to find something constructive for you to do."
I groan and let my head fall onto the table. Please don't say you signed me up for swim team again, Gran. You know how many times I've nearly drowned? Water and I do not mix.
There must be something else that you want to do.
I lift my face. I wanted Mistwick. That's all I ever wanted. She frowns, uncrossing her arms.
Why? Why do you want to go to this school so badly?
Because I wanted to show you and everyone else that I could do it. That I could be a real musician. That I could be... I pause to swallow, then whisper. That I could be like her.
Your mother.
I nod, my eyes dropping to the tabletop.
Amelia.
Graham sighs heavily.
Your mother would have been so proud of you. Even if you didn't go to this school, she'd tell you that you don't need to prove anything, that you're a strong, smart girl, with or without Mistwick.
I scowl, my hands knotting into fists on my lap. How would I know what she'd say? You never talk about her. It's like she never even existed. Even Mrs. O'Grady tells me more than you do. Gran turns away, shaking her head.
You don't understand.
I stand up, my fists planted on the table. I understand that my music reminds you of her, and that makes you sad. And I understand that's why you don't want me to go to Mistwick. I understand that you're happy I blew my audition.
Is that what you think?
She whispers, turning back to me. It's what I know. I know you hate music craft and Mistwick, but it's all I had of her, and now I don't even have that. And now I don't even know who I am or what I'm supposed to do. I wish she'd never gotten in that car 8 years ago. Graham's face creases. She rubs her arms like she's cold and stares through the window by the fridge into the murky twilight.
It wasn't a car accident, Amelia.
I freeze.
What?
Graham sits, picking nervously at her nails.
Your mother didn't die in a car accident. I didn't tell you the truth because the truth is, I don't know how she died. There are still so many unanswered questions, and I wanted you to have the closure I couldn't have. So I lied, telling myself I'd set the record straight one day. But sit down, Amelia, and I will tell you the truth, or as much of it as anyone knows. You deserve that, and I've kept it from you for too long.
I stare at her, stunned. The story she always told me, when she spoke of it at all, was that my mom died in a car crash. It's what I believed for 8 years. Now she's telling me that was a lie? That something else happened and she's kept it hidden all this time? She picks up the flute case and sets it between us, slowly opening it so that the silver barrel glints in the light coming through the window over the sink. She takes out the photo of my mom and sighs deeply, her thumb gently rubbing the paper.
Susan was exceptionally gifted,
Gran says at last, her eyes shiny with tears.
Your grandfather and I were delighted. We gave her everything, the best lessons, the best instruments. She could play such spells. There was no doubt of her getting into a good school. But even we hadn't expected she'd make it to the famous Mistwick. The day her acceptance letter came was the day we finally realized how truly special our Susie was. She would become a maestro. She would make a difference in the world with her magic. How proud we were.
Tears pricking my eyes, I whisper. What happened, Gran?
Amelia,
Gran says, looking up at me.
Even with all her talent and training, your mother still fell victim to music craft's darker consequences. No one knows exactly what happened that night, and you were too young to remember. But all we could determine was that she'd attempted a spell beyond even her skill. She was found beside a river, the trees around her all scorched to ash. All that remained was you, perfectly unscathed, asleep in a patch of green grass amid the destruction. And, of course, there was the flute. We know from the scorch marks found on it that it had to be the source of the magic that killed her. It's a wonder the thing could be salvaged.
She draws a shaking breath.
When you get into that dangerous magic, the sort maestros play, it can have terrible consequences. The smallest mistake can have the most devastating results. And whatever your mother tried to do that night by the river, it didn't work. And it killed her.
My body goes cold. Music craft killed my mom? I've heard of people getting seriously hurt or even dying from spells gone wrong, but it takes extremely powerful magic to do that kind of damage. There are some spells even the best maestros won't attempt. What was my mom doing the night she died? What sort of magic had she tried to work? I guess that's what Gran meant by unanswered questions. And now I know why she has always disapproved of music craft. Not just because it reminds her of Mom, but because it reminds her of how Mom died. Gran rests her elbows on the table and covers her face with her wrinkled hands. There's still flour dusting her knuckles. She looks so sad that I can't even feel mad at her for lying to me. In fact, I can't feel anything at all. It's like I'm made of concrete, hardening in my chair. The tears in my eyes have dried up, and I stare at the tabletop. What about my dad? I whisper. Where is he? Did you lie about him too? She shakes her head, looking angry, but not at me.
I never liked Eric to begin with. He was a wanderer, coming and going, never able to settle in one place. Couldn't even sit still long enough to marry your mother. For weeks he'd be gone, leaving the two of you alone, then showing up with piles of presents and smooth apologies. And of course, after your mother, well, he never turned up again at all.
Then her face softens a little.
But she loved him fiercely, that's for sure.
Was he a maestro too?
He dropped out of Mistwick in their senior year. He was talented, but that's all he was. Lots of talent and no discipline.
She stops, pressing her lips together.
It's better we never hear from that man again.
Did he have something to do with her death? I know Gran must be thinking it, judging by the look on her face. I always thought my father ran away because he was heartbroken. But what if it's because he was guilty? The thought makes me feel slimy inside. So that's why you don't want me to be a musician, I say. You think I'll get hurt too, like her.
Yes, I admit some selfishness in trying to discourage you. And maybe I should have just said no from the beginning. But I realized years ago that if I stopped you from playing altogether, I would lose you entirely. So, you see, that was also selfish of me.
She reaches across the table and takes my hands in hers. Her eyes are nestled in wrinkles.
But your mother wouldn't have wanted you to live in her shadow. You don't have to prove anything to her or me or anyone else. Amelia, she would want you to be yourself.
I pull my hands away. Well, I tried that, and it turned out myself wasn't good enough. I take out the Mistwick rejection letter and put it on the table. I guess you got what you want. I'm nothing like my mom. Gran picks up the letter.
You haven't opened it.
I know what it says. I jump to my feet, my chair sliding noisily across the linoleum floor. Maybe I'll sign up for swim team after all. At least they'll take me. I run to my room and shut the door. Curled up on my bed, I hug a pillow and stare up at the ceiling, where years ago I hung a poster with a Mistwick crest on it. On the wall is a calendar counting down to audition day. In my closet are clothes all in Mistwick navy blue. Everything I've done was for her, and now it's all falling to pieces. How do you just give up a dream you've had your whole life? Gran knocks on the door.
Amelia.
Go away.
Amelia.
With a groan, I force myself to my feet and go open the door. She's standing in the hallway with my flute assembled, and now she holds it out to me. The silver barrel reflects both our faces, warped into caricatures.
Take it,
she says, an odd look on her face. I don't want it. I shouldn't ever have picked it up in the first place. I don't deserve it.
Amelia.
Maybe donate it to someone. Give it to some other better musician. Someone better than me, who will do Mom proud. She starts to argue, then shakes her head.
Fine, if that's what you want. But it's going to be mighty awkward when you show up at school without an instrument to play.
I blink. Huh? Gran pulls the Mistwick letter from her pocket. She's opened it up, and now she raises it to my eyes. I can't help but glance at the words, my stomach reeling. Then I freeze and read it more slowly, start to finish. Reaching out, I take the paper from Gran and grip it so tight that it rips a little. Dear Miss Jones, I read the letter a third time and do not breathe even once until I reach the Cordially, Euphonia LaRue, Head Maestro, Mistwick School of Music Craft at the very bottom of the page, over a wax seal stamped with Mistwick's crest. Fixed to the bottom of the paper is a shiny purple ticket. Gran, I look up at her, my hand starting to shake. I got in. Chapter 5. The Flight of the Purple Bumblebee. A month later, I stand at the end of the driveway with a duffel bag, my flute case, and a tin of cookies baked by Gran, pinching myself because I'm still not sure this day is actually happening. I'm wearing my favorite pair of hiking boots, a brand new pair of overalls, and a jacket tied around my waist. Gran wanted me to wear a dress, but the only one I liked is the one that I burned to a crisp. And the only other one I own is pink and lacy, and I am not showing up at my new school looking like I just crawled off the Easter Bunny's lap. It's so early, there's still fog hunkered in the pines. And though it's light out, the sun hasn't yet risen. Everything's wet with dew. Down the road, Mrs. O'Grady's rooster is screeching to the sky. It's almost 6:30, I say. What if they forgot to come for me? Gran grunts, like she hopes they have. My stomach is twisted up with nerves, but mostly I'm too excited to feel scared. I've never been further than a 2-hour train ride to the city, and now I'm going halfway across the country. Is this how they picked up Mom? I ask. Gran nods.
But it was raining that morning, she adds softly. I'll never forget.
The street is awfully quiet. All around us, in the dim morning light, the other houses sit silent and still. I start to get anxious, worrying something's wrong. Maybe the maestros changed their minds about me. Maybe... A tingle of music shivers through the air. My chin jerks up. What's that sound? Gran sighs.
Sounds like a church organ, just like it did when it came for your mother.
It's getting closer, I shout, just as I realize the noise is coming from the sky. I look up to see a storm cloud has gathered out of nowhere. It hangs right above our house, lightning snapping and thunder rolling. And over it all, the sound of organ music splits the sky, rapid, aggressive notes bursting in the air. Whoever is behind the music must be a powerful musician indeed, playing with a skill that leaves me awestruck. The cloud is clearly some sort of spell, but I can't tell who's controlling it. Gran pulls me close, muttering under her breath.
Honestly, I don't know why a simple school bus wouldn't suffice. Always the dramatics with these people.
Then all at once, the cloud dissipates, and there in its place hovers a zeppelin. Whoa, I breathe. Hanging in the sky like a great whale, the airship is shiny and purple, with a swirling strip of piano keys down the side under the words Mistwick School of Music Craft. Propellers whir on its tail and fins. The gondola underneath bristles with pipes, and they're belching golden clouds of magic with the swell of organ music.
Teleportation spell, Gran says, to my surprise.
She glances at me.
They always smell of cinnamon. Your mother told me that.
I take a sniff and find she's right. Teleportation spells are very rare and very dangerous. I've never even seen one, much less attempted one. Only maestros are allowed to play them. A hatch under the gondola suddenly drops open, and a metal ladder slides down toward us, with a man clinging to the bottom rungs. As the ladder lowers, his black tie flutters free from his crisp white collar. The cuffs of his sleeves are circled with gold bands, and the front of his dark coat gleams with shiny buttons. He looks like an airplane pilot, except instead of wings pinned to his hat, there's a little silver zeppelin. When the ladder stops a foot off the ground, he leaps down and lands neatly in front of us.
"Ticket, miss?"
Still stunned by the zeppelin's sudden appearance, I hand over the ticket that came with my acceptance letter. The man trades me back a piece of grape gum.
"For the motion sickness," he says, winking. "Are you Amelia, then?"
I nod, still speechless.
"Excellent! You can call me Jenkins."
He turns to Gran.
"And this lovely lady is?"
Gran snorts.
"This lovely lady is the one who will drag you by your ear into court if you let anything happen to my granddaughter."
Jenkins bows to her, sweeping off his hat and pressing it to his heart.
"I assure you, no child comes to harm whilst in my care, madam. This is the safest ship in the world. You have my oath."
Then he straightens and whistles, and a tiny shape drops from the gondola's hatch. It speeds toward us before pulling up in a sweep of feathers. It's a gray parrot with a red tail, and it's got a little gold band around each claw.
"This is Captain," Jenkins says. "He'll see to your bags."
The parrot lands on his shoulder and blinks at me. Jenkins sighs.
"I said, he'll see to your bags. Captain, don't be rude. Can't you see this is a very important passenger?"
I could swear the bird rolls his eyes. He takes off with a squawk, then begins to whistle. Threads of magic curl from his beak and surround my luggage like a lasso. The bags lift into the air, and Captain flies around them, guiding them up to the zeppelin. I gape up at him. I've heard that parrots and certain other musical animals can work magic, but I've never seen it happen before.
"All right," says Gran, though she still sounds doubtful. "I suppose this is it."
I'm bouncing with excitement and impatience, but before I can go, she pulls me into a massive hug.
"You be careful, sweetheart. Brush your teeth. And remember, you can change your mind at any moment and come right back home."
"Gran..."
"And write to me every week."
"I'll email, Gran. Remember, I set the computer up for you." She makes a face.
"As if I'll recall how to use that thing."
"You will, Gran. I love you."
"I love you."
Pulling away, I climb up the ladder, higher and higher, till I can see over the roof of the house and across the woods. I can even see my treehouse tucked under the canopy. The wind pulls at me and the ladder sways, but I'm too excited to even be afraid. At the top, I pause to look down at Gran, no bigger than my thumb below me. "Bye, Gran," I shout, waving. I'm not even sure she can hear me. Then I turn and scramble up through the hatch. I find myself in a large, open cabin with lots of comfy-looking chairs that swivel so you can look out the many windows into the sky beyond. The floor is made of gleaming wood planks, and a big curving desk with lots of controls and a wooden wheel is tucked into the tapered nose of the gondola. At the back is an enormous pipe organ. An old woman is hunched over it, banging on the keys like she's playing whack-a-mole. Jenkins follows me up and sits in the pilot seat. Captain lands on a perch beside him and begins grooming his feathers.
"Welcome aboard the Bumblebee,"
Jenkins says cheerfully.
"You're my first pickup, which means you get any seat you want."
"Hurry it up, Jenkins,"
yells the old lady over her organ music.
"We're on a schedule."
"We're going, we're going. Don't pop your dentures,"
Jenkins yells back. Then he winks at me and adds in a low voice,
"Miss Myra's the best organist in the world, but don't tell her I said so."
Are we going straight to Mistwick? I ask.
What? Not yet. We've got a full day ahead, kid.
He picks up a stack of papers and waves them at me.
And a tight schedule. Next stop, London.
Taking a seat, I strap on my seatbelt and then lean to the window, looking down at Gran. I can barely make her out. I wave furiously, grinning so she can see that this is fine, totally fine, completely fine. Until the old lady in the back plays a crashing glissando, and suddenly Gran blurs along with the whole world below the Zeppelin, hidden behind a cloud of gold smoke. The house, the road, the woods, all smear together and then vanish. And suddenly, the Zeppelin is soaring through a whirling kaleidoscope. Startled, I fall back, staring through the window at the stream of colors. It's like being inside a washing machine with a bunch of open paint cans. Soon, I feel so dizzy I think I'm going to throw up. An explosion of feathers startles me and I yelp. Then I realize it's just the parrot, landing on the seat beside me.
Gum?
It squawks.
Gum for the kiddos! Gum for the sickos!
Quickly, I unwrap the stick and shove it in my mouth. The taste of grape bursts on my tongue, and at once, the dizziness passes and my stomach settles. The parrot bobs like he's pleased, then flies back to Jenkins. I feel like I'm in a spaceship warping through the universe. Ahead, through the wide windshield, all I can see is a long, infinite tunnel of blurring colors. I feel like I'm falling down an endless rabbit hole into a strange new world. This is happening. This is really happening. I'm going to Mistwick. My mother's school. The place that has been so much in my dreams that it feels like a dream itself. Behind me, Miss Myra attacks the organ keys, pumping out the teleportation spell that's bending the fabric of space all around us. I hope desperately that she doesn't miss a note. Who knows what would happen if she did? I imagine myself being spread out, a million pieces across a million miles, or the Zeppelin suddenly appearing in the middle of a mountain or a stormy sea. Despite the fact we're moving at probably a kajillion miles an hour, the airship feels like it's standing still. So I unbuckle and walk to the front, where Jenkins is feeding barbecue potato chips to his parrot. His feet are crossed on the dashboard.
"Well, what do you think of my magic Zeppelin?"
he asks. "Why doesn't everyone travel by teleportation spell all the time?" I ask. "Seems much cooler than boring old cars." He points a thumb toward Miss Myra in the back.
"Only 16 people in the world are licensed to teleport anything bigger than a refrigerator. And soon, there'll only be 15.
He shouts around a mouthful of chips.
"How old are you, Miss Myra? Like 103? Why haven't you retired yet?"
"You better not be eating food on my Zeppelin, Jenkins, you moose."
"Your Zeppelin, Miss Myra," Jenkins bellows. "Your Zeppelin.
I ought to drop you off on a desert island."
"You cheeky baboon. I've been teleporting this leaky balloon all over the globe since before you were born."
"Leaky?" I echo, feeling a spike of alarm.
"Don't panic, kid. This thing is reinforced with more safety spells than you could play in a lifetime."
Jenkins laughs and grabs the wheel of the Zeppelin.
"Still, you better sit down and buckle up."
I hurry back to my seat and strap in just as the Zeppelin begins to slow, so hard and so fast that I'm thrown against the seatbelt. In the back, Miss Myra holds a long, final note, then releases the keys with a cackle. Outside, a storm cloud surrounds the airship, obscuring any view of the outside. Lightning streaks in front of me, and I pull back, gasping as the propellers on the fins suck away the clouds. Then the storm fully clears. I press my face to the window and stare. Behind me, Jenkins opens the hatch and descends once more on the retractable ladder. The bumblebee is hovering over a busy street. Taxis and cars and red double-deckers blur below, while the sidewalks are packed with people. In the distance, I see a huge clock tower and a cathedral. Westminster Abbey, I think, where some of the greatest spells in the world are performed. I'm in London, in a whole other country. My old life is an entire ocean away. For a moment, I'm sure I'm dreaming. I press my hands to the window and look out across the great city. There's a river snaking beneath gorgeous old bridges, and a great big Ferris wheel that I decide I have to ride on one day. Ancient-looking buildings mix with modern skyscrapers, and I wonder which one the Queen lives in. This is also the home of one of the greatest symphonies in the world, the London Philharmonic, the great heroes of World War II who staved off an enemy attack by playing Baroque warning spells for 3 days straight. Looking down, I see Jenkins take a purple ticket from another student. Grinning, I find a latch on the window and open it up, then lean out. "Hello, down there!" The boy on the sidewalk looks up.
"Hey, it's Amelia Jones."
"Hello, Jai." He waves wildly. His dad is there too, and he only gives Jai a stiff handshake in farewell. But Jai looks far from sad as he leaps aboard, his eyes wide. Looking all around, he finally settles his gaze on me.
"Amelia Matilda Jones," he shouts again, throwing his arms wide.
I giggle. That's not my middle name. He shrugs, unbothered.
"It was a guess. No, don't tell me. I'll figure it out. But look at you. You got in."
"I got in."
"Me too."
"Yeah," I laugh. "I can see that."
"And we're on a teleporting purple zeppelin."
"I can see that too." He whoops and does a cartwheel across the open floor. When he reaches Miss Myra, he plants himself on the bench beside her and throws an arm around her shoulders. She looks startled.
"Hello, little old lady,"
Jai cries.
"Look at this, an organ on a zeppelin."
He reaches out like he's going to press the keys. Miss Myra slaps his hand. Laughing, Jai jumps up and runs back to me.
"Isn't this great? Isn't this the best day of your life?"
"Take your seats,"
calls Jenkins, sliding back into the pilot's chair.
"Next stop, Taiwan."
We do 14 more pickups that day, and sometimes one student boards, while other times there's a whole group of them, all waiting with families at their designated pickup locations. In some places, it's the middle of the night. Each time the Zeppelin comes to a stop, I gape at the surroundings. A quiet street outside Kyoto, where we pick up Hana, a percussionist. I stare at the wooden houses with their curving roofs, and the moon shining on a slow river winding through rice paddies behind her house. Next is a townhouse in Philadelphia, where we add a pair of twins, Jamal and Amari, both violinists. Their whole family has come to send them off, 30 or 40 people crowding the street. We stay there the longest, because each of them has to hug each twin. When Jamal and Amari finally make it aboard, they both look a bit dizzy. We visit Berlin, Dallas, Christchurch, and others that come and go like TV channels being flipped. Each one adds new faces to the Zeppelin's cabin, until nearly every seat is taken, and the air is filled with a blur of voices, all different languages and accents. They all speak English, but it's clear the one language we're all most fluent in is musicraft. And everyone is quick to compare instruments and tell exaggerated stories of their auditions. But shy to join in the conversations, I instead glue myself to the window and watch everything like it's a dream I'm about to wake up from, and I don't want to forget any of it. I store up images of the world like they're photographs, trying to decide which ones I want to visit again. I want to stand in those streets and close my eyes and just listen. Is this how my mom felt on her first trip to Mistwick? Did she travel to any of these places and listen to the music of these faraway cities? I feel like with each passing hour, I'm getting closer and closer to her, as if she might actually be waiting at Mistwick for me, like she's been there all this time. We take a brief lunch break on a beach in Acapulco, where Jenkins buys us the best tacos I've ever eaten in my life. We make a picnic of it right there on the sand, getting salsa all over our clothes. And Miss Myra nearly explodes when she sees the mess we make of ourselves. But Jai gives her his churros and flashes his ear-to-ear smile, and she softens. Finally, as we're drifting through the endless kaleidoscope tunnel, Miss Myra pounding on her organ keys, Jenkins gets on the announcement system and says,
"Next stop, the Mistwick School of Music Craft."
I'm half asleep, my head propped on the window, but when I hear that, I join everyone else in a cheer. Jai does another cartwheel, but there's not enough space now, and he crashes awkwardly into the two violinists from Philadelphia, who yell at him to cut it out. I think we're all on a bit of a sugar high, thanks to Captain continually bringing us as much grape gum as we want. And everyone's starting to get edgy. A few people put headphones on. You can only listen to the same loud organ spell so many times before you start to go a little loopy. Jai plunks down beside me, grinning.
"We're almost there. Are you excited?"
I laugh. "Of course."
"You have to shout it, like this."
He spins in his chair and beats on his chest.
"I am the champion of the world!"
As the yell rips from Jai's throat, Jenkins spins the airship's wheel, and the bumblebee comes to a shuddering, clunking halt, Miss Myra's organ wailing. Jai is thrown forward, smashing his face into the window.
"I'm okay,"
he says, blinking.
"I'm okay."
But no one's paying him attention. Instead, we're all stuck to the windows, staring down as the Zeppelin descends over forests of white trees with yellow leaves. Aspens, I think. In the distance, the Rocky Mountains jut against the evening sky. Even with a magic airship, it's taken all day to pick up the kids, and my stomach's growling for dinner. Finally, Jenkins calls out,
"Welcome to Mistwick!"
And there it is. The Mistwick School of Music Craft sits high in a vale beneath jagged, snow-capped peaks. The main building is enormous, 5 or 6 stories tall. It's like a fairy tale castle and a log cabin all in one. And the setting sun reflects on the windows, making them seem as if they're on fire. They overlook a small lake that has fountains sprouting from its center. To the right and left of the main building are more log cabin-style structures, each several stories high. It reminds me of pictures I've seen of luxury ski resorts, only without the chairlifts crooking their way up the mountain. The whole place glitters in the fading light of day. Golden walls and diamond lake and dark forest beyond. We climb down the ladder, everyone yawning after the long day, but still looking excited. Captain perches on the dash, croaking,
"Have a nice life! Have a nice life!"
at each of us as we walk by, until Jenkins reminds him he's supposed to be transporting luggage. Then Jenkins takes out a fife and plays a transporting spell to lower down Victoria, a guitarist in a wheelchair. She waves at the rest of us as she floats down and reaches the ground first, borne on a cloud of glittering gold light that pours from the fife. When my foot touches the ground, a thrill runs through me. My heart pounds like a drum. After years of dreaming, I'm finally here. Chapter 6. Nocturne, nocturne, who's there? We gather on the sloped lawn in front of the main building, surrounded by luggage and instruments. The sun has set, and now shadow begins to creep over the campus. Hearing a distant, low growl of thunder, I look up but see no clouds. Still, I untie my jacket and pull it on. Jenkins is the last one off the ladder, and as he jumps down, a woman comes running toward us. She is small and primly dressed, with very short blonde hair and an expression of fury, like an angry little fairy.
"You're late, Mr. Jenkins," she says, all out of breath. "The other Zeppelins landed hours ago. You've got to stop chatting every time you make a stop, and don't tell me you stopped for tacos again."
Jenkins grins and holds out a wrapper to the woman.
"Brought you one, Miss March. I know you like extra guacamole."
She scowls, but takes the taco. Don't think this lets you off the hook. Shaking her head, she turns to us kids. Come, come, students. You've missed dinner thanks to your incompetent pilot. There's still some left, if a little cold. Hurry now. We follow her up the grassy hill, dragging our instruments.
Farewell, young musicians,
Jenkins calls out, holding on to the ladder as it rises back into the Zeppelin. He waves grandly, his hair fluttering, and adds,
And farewell to you, Miss March.
Miss March rolls her eyes, but I notice spots of color in her cheeks. I think somebody has a little crush on the Zeppelin captain, I whisper to Victoria, who rolls beside me. She giggles, then stops her wheelchair to look up. Miss March brings us to a halt in front of the main building, which has the words Harmony Hall over the front doors. It has a peaked roof and huge timber walls and lots of windows. Six giant logs rise vertically to support the front overhanging roof, each one carved with spiraling music notes. On either side of the door, wild horse statues rear up, wooden manes and tails flowing with lifelike detail. A huge banner above the doors shouts, Welcome, new students. And in smaller letters under that, Audientibus Musica Audest. I stare at it, my heart fluttering. I'm half afraid to blink, in case it all were to vanish. Children, gather around, says the woman. I am Ellie March, the Dean of Students. We're currently putting together dinner for you since I'm afraid you missed mealtime. Give us 15 minutes and everything will be ready, I assure you. In the meantime, wait here and, enjoy the view. I'll be back shortly for you. She hurries inside, leaving us standing on the front steps. Swinging my flute case at my side, I turn and survey the lake, the trees, the mountains beyond. The school buildings are arranged in a semicircle around the water, all timber-framed like Harmony Hall, except for what looks like a glass concert hall on the other side of the lake. I spot a soccer field and a gym, and what might be an indoor pool. And there are statues everywhere of composers and maestros, both past and present. Bach and Mozart stand nearby, looking solemnly out at the mountains. And I turn and find the serious stone face of Toru Takemitsu frowning down at me, a plaque at the base of the statue telling of his great achievements and most famous spells. The sky is fading from red to violet, the buildings growing indistinct in the shadows. I breathe in deep, relishing the cool clarity of the air, though I know I'm going to need to adjust to the altitude before I attempt any long spells. Closing my eyes, I listen for the school's music. It's soft and whispery, an easy nocturne of murmuring voices, chilly mountain wind, the lake lapping below, and a distant owl's low hoot. The other kids seem too excited to stay still, and a few wander down to the lake while the rest spread across the nearby grass, looking around. Jai climbed onto the statue of Mozart and is playing air guitar, and Hana is yelling at him to get down before he gets us all in trouble. I figure it won't hurt to take a look around. I'm itching to explore. And anyway, Miss March did say to enjoy the view. So I slip away and follow a stone path that goes around Harmony Hall. I pass more stone maestros on the way, and there's just enough light to make out their names. Fanny Mendelssohn, Sulhi Alwadi, Samuel Coleridge Taylor, and many others. I feel a sudden chill and shiver. Maybe I should go back. It's pretty dark over here, and I don't want to get lost on my first day. I start to turn around, then hear a soft voice. Amelia. Surprised, I turn a bend in the path and find myself standing at the edge of the forest. To my left is a large amphitheater, bleachers and stage all sunken into the grassy ground. There's no sign of the person who called my name. Maybe it was my imagination. Suddenly, a wind pours in from my left, and all the trees start to sway and rustle. I gasp. When the wind rushes through their leaves, they don't sound like regular trees at all. Instead, the noise they make is like an orchestra tuning up. violins humming, flutes and oboes trilling, groaning cellos and twanging harps and deep, deep tubas. The music is faint, like listening to a recording at the lowest volume, but there's no mistaking that it's completely magical. And in the canopy, among those swaying branches, the faintest golden dust swirls. These are no ordinary trees.